This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 441 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. So this is the second Saturday of October. This year, we get five Saturdays in October. So for the next four shows, The Drunken Odyssey will be featuring The Drunken Odyssey versus The Curator of Schlock, welcoming Jeff Schuster back after a three-year gap. The last time he was on the show was episode 284 for Horror Movie Poetry Night 4, all the way back on episode 284. So this month, Jeff and I are going to talk about four standout horror films of the last decade. These aren't necessarily the films we consider to be the absolute best, but I think a case can be made that they may be four of the most interesting horror films of the last decade. And today's episode is devoted to the 2018 film Mandy, directed by Panos Cosmatos. Let's get to the talk.
And now, for something that is not the last thing we just did.
Well, dear listeners, I'm joined by a dear friend and the longest contributor as a writer to thedrunkenodyssey.com, Jeffrey Schuster, who is the curator of Schlock. So hello, Jeff.
Hello, John. Thank you for having me.
So we're recording this a little bit early, but I thought maybe the best way to celebrate October, the Halloween season, would be to talk about recent horror movies with you. And you right away recommended Mandy, which slipped by me in 2018, so I was kind of glad to return to it.
Yeah, it slipped by a lot of people. My friend and I were going to try and catch it in the theater, but I think it was one of those one-week-only things, and it was out of there, so we got it on pay-per-view instead and watched it at home. So, but I personally think it was my favorite movie of 2018. I mean, this, I can't say a lot of movies have stood out this past decade. On the blog, I did a whole year of movies from this decade, and I was struggling by the end of the year. So I don't know. I'm being too mean, maybe. And to be fair, I haven't seen every movie that's come out this decade, so there are probably gems I've missed. So,
but you've seen a bunch. It's not like you've not been trying to keep up or anything.
Oh, yeah.
So what makes Mandy special in your view? And is it special because it's schlock, or is it special because it isn't schlock, or is it special because you don't know?
I think it's special because I don't know. I don't even know whether to make out if it's a horror movie. I think it is, mood-wise, it feels like a horror movie, but we're almost getting into crime vigilante territory. I mean, it's a revenge film at the end of the day, but it's... I don't know the style of it, the use of color, that wonderful score by, what's his name?
That would be Johan Johansson.
Yes. I don't think I was too familiar with him before seeing this movie. Do you know him at all?
I don't, but yeah, I was trying to think of, you know, how to describe Mandy. And so I said that this is what I wrote in my notes. Mandy is a psychedelic tone poem that mashes up so many archetypes and odd details, yet at times feels absurdly realistic. It's what we might have gotten if Stanley Kubrick directed Sidehackers.
Maybe.
It's very similar to the plot of Sidehackers, and yet it's visionary, it's goofy, it looks like what a troublesome LSD trip might be like.
Yeah, I can see that.
Just the way, the very peculiar lighting and the way that the lighting tends not to stand still, even though there's no reason necessarily for the lighting to be shifting. Wikipedia refers to this as a horror art film.
I guess you could call it what's the term I've heard recently? There was a term for this, like horror art house cinema. That was like a big thing that came about. Movies like Hereditary is considered one of those. The more recent Midsommar, I think, was considered one of those. I'm trying to think.
Neon Demon,
yeah, that's probably considered one of those, yeah, like art house horror. Yeah, I think that's what they call art house horror.
I hated the Neon Demon. Yeah,
I haven't seen it. It keeps staring at me to watch. It has one of the Fannings in it, right?
I think so.
Sister, maybe? Yeah.
The Neon Demon, like the production design was great, and it's a story about models, I think, in Los Angeles, and I didn't care from start to finish about the entire movie. It just left me so cold. And I either don't love art films enough or don't love horror movies, or I kind of get suspicious when someone tries to mash up the two. Like, oh, well, mine is a thinky horror movie that's going to be very fussy about its design, and you have to like it because of how bougie we're making it. And there's just something about that, although it could just be, you know, how the characters are written and how it's acted.
Yeah,
I get that models maybe aren't the warmest people.
I would think so, yeah, but I don't know.
I'm not sure I completely agree, but, you know, like, if that's the part of the theme, well, I guess it works. But that also means I end up just feeling very little. And in a good movie, I care about what happens to all the characters, including the very bad characters.
Right. I mean, you do care about the characters of Mandy. Okay. I will say this. Well, not all of them, obviously not. Well, we'll get to them, but
I think I care about all of them.
Even Jeremiah Sands.
Well, caring about doesn't mean I don't want him punished.
Interested. You find them interesting. Is that maybe a better?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, there's a personality at work, and you know, the way it's written, and I think this is so important, you know, he is the absolute villain and he's out of his mind. Right. Let's give people a plot summary. So you let me know if I got this kind of right, Jeff. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I watched it recently again. So
a lumberjack and his girlfriend who live deep in the woods are stalked by a Christian cult who collaborate with a bizarre S&M motorcycle gang called the Black Skulls, whose minds were permanently fried by a malicious dose of LSD they were given as drug couriers. The Horn of Abraxas summons these Cenobite cosplayers, and things do not go smoothly when Jeremiah, the cult leader, can't persuade Mandy to worship his questionable musical prowess. There follows a bloody, gory vision quest of revenge.
Yeah, that about sums it up. That's I was stifling laughter there. I don't know if it came over on the mic. Well, when you say it like that, it sounds ridiculous. Okay.
Well, you know, you know, there are just so many, we could call them paradoxes or contradictions in the movie, but the characters are written so well. And, you know, we get them revealed to us. And one of the other really amazing things about the way this is written, and like, I think that's one of the interesting things about schlock, or at least the best schlock, is this good writing or bad writing? Like, it's going to surprise you, and it's like, is this because they have no idea what they're doing, or are they just making something that feels different than anything we've experienced before? So normally the inciting incident in a feature happens at minute 10, and it used to be a thing that like agents and producers like would do as a test of a script they haven't seen. Just open up to page 10. All right, is this where the plot gets going? If not, okay, next script. I'm not interested.
Oh, like you look at Death Wish as an example, like you get a little bit in Hawaii and then it's grungy New York City. And then the incident happens probably at page 10, like you were saying. Okay. So, I mean, if we're going by another revenge type flick.
So here we get 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Before the plot kicks in, before we have the inciting incident. So we see a little bit of Red, the lumberjack played by the great, in this at least, Nick Cage. And, you know, we see him doing his job, and we get a sense that, you know, he's working in this really remote, dangerous place. And then after work, he goes even deeper in the woods to his cabin where, you know, he's got this, you know, heavy metal chick girlfriend, Mandy. Mm-hmm. She's wearing a Motley Crue Shout at the Devil shirt. So I'm guessing that's 1983.
Yeah, that's according to Wikipedia, that's when it takes place, 83. Oh, she wears a Black Sabbath shirt in another scene, too, so yeah.
Yeah, so there's like a little dose of blasphemy in each of her shirts. Also, there's a bit of a Ronald Reagan speech in the beginning where he's complaining about pornography or something.
Well, he was saying most Americans agree that it's bad, you know, and he was saying all this other stuff. And I'm kind of wondering why that's in there. Is that just to let the audience know this is the 80s, or maybe you had an opinion on that? I don't know.
I think it's to help the setting. And I also think it kind of shows how out of touch Reagan was with at least the people who would be in Mandy.
Right, right. That makes sense. He, you notice he turns the radio off pretty abruptly when it's on.
Yeah. He's a lumberjack. Like he's using a chainsaw to, you know, cut trees down, and he has what seems like a pretty special relationship with this woman, and they're both kind of weirdos, and they, you know, really complement each other well. But if most horror movies are bad because we don't care about the characters, well, this gives us 20 minutes with these characters, and they really kind of set the hook deep, I think, before things start to go wrong.
Yeah, I have to admit, when I was first watching it, I was sort of wondering what's going on here, because, like, we're just getting to see them at home, having these deep talks about what their favorite planet is, and, you know.
Yeah, and they're hanging out.
Yeah, do you have a favorite planet, John?
Uranus, obviously.
I don't know. Mercury I always found interesting because that's the hot one, right? That's the, supposedly.
Oh, the hottest one. Yeah.
I guess no one's ever been there, but I don't know. But he likes Saturn. I was expecting him to say Uranus, but that didn't happen, so.
No, it's, I mean, it sounds like a romantic conversation that might be had between 12-year-olds.
Right. That makes sense.
And not a woman who looks like she's, I don't know, 36 or so, and Nicolas Cage, you know, of indeterminate age, let's just say.
I would figure maybe in this late 30s, 40s, maybe.
He looks like he's in his 40s.
Yeah, 40s.
I mean,
okay.
It's hard to say exactly, you know, like he clearly himself as the actor is clearly older, but.
Right. Obviously. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, that alone creates a certain sense of uneasiness that the inciting incident takes twice as long to get there. Kind of like at the end of a horror movie, if the movie isn't wrapping itself up and the scene just goes on and on and you're like, okay, whatever happiness we just found, like they're going to fuck this up. There's like, nope, the killer's actually still in there somewhere.
Now I'm curious, did you have any inkling of the plot before watching this movie? Did you go into it without any kind of spoilers? I'm just curious.
I had a general sense of what was going to happen.
Yeah, so did I. I kind of wish I would have gone into it without knowing what was going to happen, but you know, as is the internet, you read Mandy and then I guess a couple blurbs underneath the revenge something something. You know, yeah. We do get little chapter titles, though, before each part starts, though, which I thought was interesting.
We get is it three of them?
I think so. I think they're three. Yeah.
Right. There's the Shadow Mountains.
Yes.
That kind of set up that first bit. And then the complication called Children of the New Dawn, you know, which is this cult group. And then the last one is simply called Mandy. They use kind of that Stephen King novel font from the 80s, that one that Stranger Things keeps using.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I was wondering if Stranger Things and this were kind of channeling a similar thing. I mean, I did grow up in the 80s, so I do still remember some of that. And I mean, at least with the score and certain things.
Well, and I think that what the 1980s did for horror was, and I kind of blame Friday the 13th for having no soul and finding ways to be gory. Right. I mean, the problem with the Friday the 13th movie is like you don't care about anybody. Like it's hard.
Yeah.
Like there's so little going on that you're like, okay, you know what? I might be on the side of the killer, even though he's not emoting much, but he's the only person doing anything. Oh.
I've tried covering those for the blog, and I know there are a lot of horror fans. They love Friday the 13th, and I understand it. And I even have the first four on DVD, and it comes with a 3D glasses set for the. But yeah, you do kind of. I mean, like, have you ever seen the movie The Burning?
No, but I remember your review on it, right? It's another summer camp movie, and it has Jason Alexander. That's how much I remember from your review.
It was weird. It has Jason Alexander in it, and I think the difference between that and a lot of the Friday the 13th movies, I actually do feel bad for the kids getting killed in this. For starters, the camp is a lot. It's not just the counselors. There are. You know, kids in the campground too. And, you know, I actually do identify more with the older teens and the kids in that movie, just because, you know, these are regular people. They're not like these stereotypes, like that horrible nerdy guy in Part Three, Shelley, who I wanted to die so badly. You know, he kept wearing these stupid masks and scaring people. And I wanted to hurt him so bad. It's hard to explain. And apparently they made a Friday the 13th video game and the actor reprised his role as that character. So I might have to look into that.
Wow.
You can play as Jason and hunt him if you want. So there you go.
That's that's somebody's dream.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, it's just, I don't know. Anyway, but we do care about Red and Mandy in this. Okay.
Well, I think, What the 19...
These are cool people, okay.
What happened in 1980s horror, correct me if you think I'm wrong in this generalization, but I think visceral horror kind of went mainstream.
Yeah.
Like in the 60s, other than Night of the Living Dead, I can't think of movies that, you know, are that visceral, unless we want to go to maybe John Waters, who's not really making horror movies. They're just...
No, it was really... Yeah, Joe Bob Briggs, actually, he made a point. He did a whole description of Night of the Living Dead being made, and he says, boom, the modern horror movie was born. And some people might argue it began with Psycho, but I do, whether or not Psycho is a horror movie, I still kind of lean towards suspense with that one, but people call it a horror movie, so maybe it's a bit of both, I don't know.
Well, I would argue it's not visceral, because
right.
We don't see the knife going into the body. I mean,
that's true.
It's a great story. And, you know, like Hitchcock tricked people into thinking they saw the knife go in, like we hear it go in.
It's interesting because if you think about it, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is similar because you don't see a lot in that either, even though people think they're seeing a lot more. I mean, a lot of horrible stuff is alluded to, but you don't, like, you'll see a chainsaw going into someone through the front, but you don't actually see it, you know, even though I do consider that a visceral horror movie, though. So yeah,
the one time we see a chainsaw go directly into the flesh or seem to is when Leatherface drops the chainsaw on his
own
leg.
That's right. At the end, you're right about that. We do see that.
And then, you know, there's the scene where the young woman finds herself in the house, and the deeper she goes into the house as she's trying to run away, like she just keeps finding more and more horrors.
The bones on the floor.
The bones and the sculptures and the furniture. And it's like, oh, like. And I think even though that's, you know, we could argue about whether or not that's visceral, but it's just so nasty.
It's a bad place. It's a bad place.
But by the 1980s, that kind of went mainstream. And I think that we could argue about whether the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a well-written movie or not, but it seemed like they were trying.
Oh, yeah. And I feel bad because I know with part two, they originally wanted to make it a straight-up comedy, but the producers got mad and made them recut the film and change it. But it was supposed to be a full-on comedy. But yeah, I'm trying to think though. Yeah, but if you think about 60s horror, it's mainly there's a lot of gothic horror in the 60s. That's the big thing. And Night of the Living Dead is where it all shifts. You know, you're getting away from Dracula's castle.
The scene of the little girl zombie with a gardening trowel killing her mom in the basement. I don't care how much horror you've seen, like that's
that's still uneasy. I got an audio version of Night of the Living Dead once, like an audio play, and they did that scene, but they had the little girl talking while she was doing it, which didn't make any sense because she was a zombie, but that's neither here nor there. I'm getting a soft draft, but no, that's a horrible scene. Plus they also mess up the mother screaming and they make it all high pitched and distorted while you're hearing the knife going in. And you know, it's not fun.
You know, it's a visceral scene and it's hard to be visceral just through sounds. If you're going to talk about killing,
right.
If you're going to talk about, I don't know, people throwing up, maybe, but I'm not exactly sure what purpose that would serve. So in some ways, I think it's a horror movie that is nostalgic for other horror movies. I mean, I forget what year Side Hackers came out. I only know about Side Hackers because of Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, I think I saw it once on Mystery Science Theater. And I think that was one of the movies that I think they was that one of the movies they later on said they shouldn't have done. they didn't screen it properly, or
they didn't realize there was a rape that turned into a murder. They watched like a half hour and they're like, yeah, this should work, we can make fun of this, let's now that we've vetted and screened it. And they didn't watch the whole thing, and it didn't occur to them that could have been in the movie, so they had to cut it in such a way and then kind of allude to it, because it turns out, you know, the sort of PG rating they had to go with, like, no, there's no way.
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of feel like Nicolas Cage has redeemed himself for that B scene in the remake of The Wicker Man.
Oh, man. I have a quick story about that. You know, I did that one for the blog, and I think I was trying... I mean, I knew it was a bad film. I was making a joke that everybody said I have to watch the horror classic, The Wicker Man. So I went and watched the Nicolas Cage one. And
that's not the one.
After I was done with the review and sent it off to you, I think I laughed for half an hour at how ridiculous it is. You can watch clips from it. I think there's a scene of him drop kicking Lily Sobieski into pottery. It doesn't make any sense.
He was one of the producers, and his character wears a sweater vest.
In The Wicker Man?
Yeah. And okay. I'm like, I can't root for anyone wearing a sweater vest.
No, he's terrible. Here's the thing. Do you ever see the original Wicker Man?
I haven't.
Okay. I didn't until recently either. I mean, I did it before I saw the Nick Cage version, but I like the guy in that more, because at the end of the day, he is a cop he is a police officer. He's trying to find a missing girl who he thinks has been kidnapped or murdered, and that's why he's there. I mean, he may be uptight and all this other stuff, whereas the Nick Cage character in the remake is just, he's horribly obnoxious throughout the entire film. He's just...
And not in a cool way. Like, if it was Bruce Willis, like, he's a dick, but it's like, okay, like, he's a dick, but... he's a dick in his own special way. And it's like, no.
I don't know. People do consider it an unintentional comedy now. So there's that. Nick Cage has been in some bad films during the 2000s. He was in Drive Evil. Did you see that one? Him and Amber Heard were in that.
I think that was Drive Angry or Drive Mad?
Drive Angry, not Drive Evil. Drive Angry, yes. And I think he plays either an angel who was stuck in hell or a devil from hell or an angel. I don't know. And he's... it almost reminded me of Ghost Rider, but it wasn't Ghost Rider, even though he's in Ghost Rider. And I
twice he's in Ghost Rider.
Yes.
And I think, yeah, I think those films were unfairly maligned.
What, Ghost Rider?
Yeah, especially the second one.
Oh, I love the second one.
Although I think they were both called Ghost Rider, which is confusing.
No, the second one was Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance.
Okay, Spirit of Vengeance, because that was directed by the team that brought us Crank and Crank 2. And
it had Idris Elba as a French monk, I believe, in it.
Yep. And Ciaran Hinds as the devil. Peter Fonda played the devil in the first one.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not great movies. The second one is pretty watchable, but that's kind of after they've already scorched the earth with all the goodwill we could have had with the first one. So,
but there's a wonderful scene in Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance where the one guy is given the power of necropsy or whatever. Anything it touches rots away, basically, right? And he goes through this trucker's lunch and picks up a sandwich and it rots away. Picks up an apple and it rots away. Picks up a Twinkie and it's fine and he eats that. It's just, I don't know. That was a nice little scene they had in there. So,
well, you know, the special effects were a little, on the Commodore 64 side at times. But I feel like, you know, the movie, it was trying to be like, let's just say there are certain Nick Cage movies where you're like, okay, this is just bad faith all around. Like nobody should feel good about anything that happened here. Like nobody should have left the house to do this.
Oh yeah.
I'm a little bit older than you. And just, you know, in the 1980s, Nicolas Cage was in masterpieces. He was in Moonstruck, a romantic comedy.
But sure, I saw that one.
If romantic comedies could be more like Moonstruck, then I like romantic comedies.
Yeah, I saw Moonstruck.
Raising Arizona, Wild at Heart, you know, like he was this really unusual actor to have become this leading man. And yet it kind of worked for these wonderful projects that he was in. And then in the 90s, he became like, okay, and now he's just the normal. He's what we should be normally thinking of as a leading man. It's like, well, that I'm not sure how we feel about. So he's like,
he was in Face Off,
like Tom Cruise, but he has better hair. Yeah. Face Off, like John Woo and Michael Bay movies. And it's like,
Joe Bob Briggs has a cameo in Face Off. Did you know that? He's the prison torturer. He's the guy who tortures the prisoners.
I saw Face Off in the theater and I was filled with such a rage. and it's one of those things where people are like, oh, but Face Off was good. I'm like, no.
I saw it three times in the theater and not by choice. Here's what happened. I think I saw it once with my family, and then I have one set of friends. They want to go see Face Off. All right, I guess I can see it again. Another set of friends, and I don't want to be the wet blanket saying I've already seen it, you know? So I saw it three times.
You're like, hey guys, I've already seen this twice, which is 10 times too many.
I probably wouldn't do that again today, but back in the day,
well,
you know.
Just I think the detail, it's like, okay. The wife, or I forget who, but their kind of, you know, romantic gesture is, let me scrape my fingers over your face. And I'm like, no one does that. No one does that. And if my wife did it, I would smack her hand away and say, no, you do not do that. Like, and the movie, right? The movie, the plot hinged on that. And I'm like, this is just. Yeah, so it was just so ridiculous in so many ways. And then you see people around, and when I see people around me kind of digging the actual drama of the story, I'm like, I feel dirty.
Like he did Con Air a month earlier, that I enjoyed more.
Oh yeah, Con Air, that's, okay, for a big dumb American movie, Con Air is like perfect.
Yes, because it had Steve Buscemi in it, and I like Steve Buscemi, so I like seeing him in. You know,
John Malkovich in a wig.
John Malkovich was the villain. Yes, yeah, that's right.
That was actually, you know, it's not a good movie, but that one was pretty watchable. You know,
yeah.
And then since, you know, the aughts, you know, he was in Adaptation.
I loved Adaptation.
And every once in a while, he shows up and reminds you, like, oh my God, like he. You know, Leaving Las Vegas, you know, like every 5 or 10 years, he will produce a movie that you're like, wow, that was pretty great. And, you know, Mandy just might be one of those movies where, mm-hmm. you know, he's acting in service of this visionary thing that is simultaneously like so many things we've seen before, but it doesn't feel like it when you watch it. you know, like the presentation is just so strange, and the beats, you know, the rhythm of the movie is so strange. And
it might be unlike any movie I've seen before, if I think about it. I don't know. I'm trying to think of something I can compare it to. I mean, we were talking about the art house movies, but it's almost meditative, but you're seeing all this horrible stuff. That makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it's it's visionary, and yet, like, it's got this visceral thing from time to time where you're like, ooh, that was gross. But then again, Jeremiah, right, giving his cult pitch to Mandy, right, they've doped her up so that she's out of her mind, and then he gives her this spiel while playing his record, which is L. Rock, you know, Hubbard-esque in its awfulness.
He asked her if she liked the Carpenters.
In 1983. Yeah, nobody likes the Carpenters in 1983. Yeah, that's and he's wearing, you know, a white robe, and you have what seems like just a nice group of white people hanging out in her living room.
One guy's drinking tea or coffee, I think, right?
Yeah, and it's one of the most alarming and gross scenes in the movie, even though there's, you know, other than slapping her, nothing gory happens in that scene.
Yeah, well, you know something bad's going to happen. I mean, the clock is ticking. She says the only words that come out of her mouth before he starts talking is the Reaper's coming or something. And I didn't know what she meant by that. I think, does she know she's going to die, that this isn't going to end well for her? Because I know she had that wasp venom stuck in her cheek or whatever that was that made her all hallucinogenic.
And that was a pretty great effect. And, yes. You know, it was definitely seemed like, you know, a practical effect. Just, oh, here's a wasp puppet that's going to be 10 times as big as a wasp should be. Is that bringing back bad memories? Do we need to talk about camp?
No, we can talk about when I was 5 years old. I was at, I think, the local firefighters threw a picnic in the town I grew up in. And I think that's what it was or something. And like, there was this bee flying about, and I'm like 5 years old, and I'm swatting at it. And it lands right on my nose and stings me on the nose. And since then, I've had a fear of bees, wasps, things that fly and sting. So, and I bawled like a baby. Of course, I was a baby, I suppose, at the time. So, I mean, but, you know. And so if you know what to put in the cage around my face when you're interrogating me, it's bees or wasps. So.
Well, all right. I will stow that away as useful information for later.
Anyway, but what do we think of what's the name of the cult again? The Children of the New Dawn.
The Children of the New Dawn, yeah.
I would name my cult that. That's a good name. That's because it doesn't really mean anything.
Well, it's really generic. And so, okay, people in the 1980s who are certainly into rock and roll, which doesn't actually seem to include the Children of the New Dawn. Which,
oh, Jeremiah Sands, he's a rock star.
I'm not sure that's rock music that he was playing. We'll try and find the isolated track. One occult figure who, you know, has been popular among rock stars is Aleister Crowley.
Right.
Who called himself a Satanist, but that would suggest a certain loyalty to Satan that I don't think would pass muster for Aleister Crowley, but he's one of the historical figures pictured in attendance on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin was obsessed with Aleister Crowley and bought one of his houses, and Ozzy has a song about Aleister Crowley. And I think David Bowie somewhere has an allusion to Aleister Crowley as well. So kind of, you know, as this rock and roll Easter egg. And he was a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn, and so was William Butler Yeats. And they once got into a struggle over the key to the temple or whatever it was.
Oh, wow.
At some point. I didn't know this. So, you know, to people who are rock and roll and on the fringe, and, you know, I, in high school, was reading Aleister Crowley books, which it's kind of funny. You know, there was certainly that panic in the 1980s. Oh, everyone's gone Satanist. And of course, that was just this very easy Pavlovian thing that kids could do to their parents is just, oh yeah, hail Satan.
Like you play the record backwards, the album backwards, and you hear messages or something. That sort of thing that was in the media. I remember that.
Yeah. And, you know, like churches were trying to inform parents about all of the crazy dangers of, you know, Satanism and rock and roll, and KISS stands for Kids in Satan Service. And it's like, I don't know, it's closer to Kabuki than Satanism. KISS would be. And one of the cures for, you know, being afraid of Aleister Crowley as this nefarious figure would be to read one of his books, and then you'd be like, okay, he's more boring than anything else. Like, he wasn't a terrible stylist, but he wrote a bunch of novels, and, you know, for the most part, he was just a weirdo. But if you connect him to Satanism, and he's kind of this popular touchstone in the counterculture, you know, he may seem nefarious, and it's like, well, he's just this goofy-looking bald guy. Hemingway tells a great story about him in A Movable Feast, where Ford Maddox Ford and Hemingway were having lunch in a cafe, and this weirdo just keeps loitering like he wants to introduce himself, but he doesn't have the nerve, and it was Aleister Crowley.
Huh. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is why that cult killing of the little boys in Tennessee.
Is that the one they made the documentary of Paradise Lost about? Yes, Paradise Lost. They were saying, oh, we found writings of Aleister Crowley by them. They did it. The kids did it. Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, and so like Damien Eccles was, you know, like, yeah, he was kind of exploring the ideas of Aleister Crowley as a writer intellectually. And they're like, it's proof that he, you know, like did these sex murders. And it's like, I'm like, okay, it's right there on the cover of the Beatles. Like, is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band now Satanist? Because it's...
He's a bored kid in high school.
And that's
I got from that.
Well, because what you see it happening in the courtroom, and Damien Eccles and his fucking lawyer, like, you know, they're walking into a trap, and Damien Eccles was thinking, oh, I can just talk my way through this because I know I'm a good person. So, yeah, I've read a lot of Aleister Crowley. And it's like, don't volunteer that information. They're going to crucify you. It doesn't matter how little you think it makes a difference. They're just looking for a reason to put you away.
Yeah.
And that was just a resurgence of the hysteria that was a response to rock and roll culture in the 80s when everybody, it was kind of mandatory. I mean, Black Sabbath started in 68 or 69. And you know, their music, some of it actually sounds like folk rock if you go back and listen to the early stuff.
I might have some of that. I have the Dio Years album, which...
This would have been pre-Dio.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
No, their first couple albums, they got some like real hard rockin' songs, and they're kind of inventing heavy metal. But they also have songs where you'd be like, ooh, I didn't think Black Sabbath could sound like that. You know, and it's this perverse thing. But, you know, when Motley Crue says Shout at the Devil... this is not a serious engagement with the occult or Satanism. This is more, let's just make people upset because it's fun.
Yeah. But what do you think of Jeremiah Sands?
Well, I think they're careful in the writing of this in that we see his influence on other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is it's a cult, but it's also like a family, right? I mean, it's a small cult. There's what, 7 or 8 people, maybe, if we don't include the bikers?
Well, no, I think the bikers are just like helpers, because they have to bribe the bikers. They just don't do things willy-nilly for him. They have to give the porker, as Jeremiah Sands called him, we have to give him over to the bikers, and they'll beat up Nick Cage for us, I guess. That's what they want. I don't know. Or Red, I should say. His character's name is Red.
The cinematography, one of the things they do when he's giving his speech to Mandy... Cinematography is by Benjamin Loeb. They filmed the actor who was Jeremiah. That's Linus Roche. And they filmed him twice. And so at times his mouth isn't moving. And at times it's like the lips bleed through and you could see him talking. Just adding to the trip that she's undergoing, because they put some LSD in her eyeball and then gave her the toxic whatever is in that special wasp you know, poison. And so because we see how everyone else kind of worships him, and I think the actor is doing such a good job, and I just feel like he's straight out of like a 1970s TV show.
Yes.
Like a grade C character actor who's only grade C because he doesn't get hired for good gigs, where he gets a really sweet gig where you've got this ambitiously written character who has to say crazy things and say them like he thinks they mean something. So, you know, the actor, I thought, hit it out of the park, and he's like charismatic enough to believe he's charismatic, but not so charismatic that we end up distracted. Like if it was Brad Pitt, it's like, okay, no, there's just give everything to Brad Pitt. We don't care. Like the guy, you know, like slightly handsome, longer hair.
Like we see through the ruse, but we understand why the cult members don't see through the ruse.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And also, because he wants to be worshipped, and this is just, this was probably happening right around Me Too, right? He's like, what do you think of my music? And then he parts his robe and we see him.
Yeah.
Which also makes that scene kind of skeezy, but I,
yeah.
It's not that I want to see more penises on film necessarily, but I do feel like in the world of film, women's bodies get exploited so much for the male gaze, and I do like disruptions of that. And you know, if women are going to be on film naked, you know, I think men should be on film naked.
But is Jeremiah Sands for the female gaze?
Well, maybe.
Okay.
Good luck to anyone who finds that. You know, and it's, and there was nothing wrong with his penis, right? I mean, it wasn't unless you're homophobic. And you're like, no, don't get excited. Don't like, okay, Mike Pence might have a very fraught time trying to watch that scene.
But Mother Marlene would be fine with it. Is the elder lady in the group.
Yeah, yeah. And so it looks like, yeah, he's trying to build up a harem, and Mandy would be his second. Unless the mother is somehow part of it, but I get the sense.
Oh, no, she's part of it. But maybe we're not counting her because he doesn't count her. Jeremiah Sands, she goes, is it something I did wrong? No, it's everything you do. And he starts laying into the verbal abuse, saying, if you don't change, you're not going to be able to ascend. And I'm like, like she's acting all nice and apologetic, and he's just yelling at her some more. It's just,
It's like, oh, he's either the apostle of a new god we've never seen before, or maybe he's just a dick.
Yeah, I think the latter. I'm I'm trying to gauge how bad he is when she's talking to him, and then we know right away. He's just
so. Now you are the expert in schlock, so you tell me.
Yes,
I'm not. How does Jeremiah schlock score against, say, other great villains?
Evil. Oh, you want him on the evil scale?
Well, maybe evil, but also the evil that we feel.
The evil that we feel? I don't understand.
Well, okay. So there's a movie called Robot Holocaust in which this central computer takes the biggest threat that humanity poses against it, the scientist, and it turns him into a giant avocado.
Okay.
That's not really persuasive evil.
No. Okay. Yeah. No, the Jeremiah Sand and the cult in this is up there. It's in the upper echelon. I argued they're not kidnap syndicate evil, but they're pretty evil. Did you remember my review for the kidnap syndicate?
Kind of.
I can't talk about this movie. People yell at me when I start talking to them about it, so I got to stop myself. But the kidnap syndicate, this was from an Italian Poliziotteca movie, which is an Italian crime movie from the 70s. And they were the worst villains I've ever seen on screen. And this cult was up there, but they weren't quite there. So they're like the benchmark I have for evil. But this group is close. But getting back, we're still on this scene, right? I mean, what do we think of how Mandy is handling herself in this scene? I have my own opinion, but maybe you have yours. Okay.
Well, I mean, she's zonked out of her mind. And because she says that thing about the Reaper, it's like, okay, maybe out of her mind is exactly how she would need to be, but maybe being out of her mind makes her more cognizant rather than less of the full implications of what's happening. Maybe. if she weren't drugged, maybe she could have protected herself better. This music, yeah, I like this music.
That, or maybe she could have hit a knife or something on her. I could see her fighting back. I mean, granted, there's so many of them, but.
Well, okay. As, you know, the perfect woman, at least for Red, right? It's so interesting. She's so gentle, or at least she seems really, really gentle. And she has the actress, right? Andrea Riseborough has just these really big eyes, and she's real thin. And I don't know if this is makeup or if this is the actor herself, but, you know, there's a scar going down her face, which makes her this flawed.
Oh, wait a minute, though. Did the scar come from the wasp bite, though? Or was that there before it?
No, that was there.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know, which kind of makes it interesting that Jeremiah fixates on her. Like, no, she has to join the cult. She's too beautiful. And if you have certain standards, like, well, she's got a scar going down her face. Like, that's
okay
for a lot of people. That would be a deal breaker, which I think makes us root for, you know, Red and Mandy all the more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, she had a troubled childhood too, from what we heard. Like, she told the story about her father and the starlings.
Yeah.
About how to kill the baby starlings. And, like, I don't know how old she was when she saw this or something.
Which reminds me of The Silence of the Lambs, in which Clarice Starling has a story to tell about the butchering of the lambs.
Ah, okay. That's a direct reference. Okay.
Well,
the starlings. Could be. Yeah. Okay. No, I bet it is. I bet it is. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why this movie, like, do I think it's great or do I think it's not great, but interesting? Ultimately, I would have to say it's great just because it holds my attention the whole time. And
it does. It's 2 hours long. I didn't get bored at all while watching it. I'm like Terminator Dark Fate, but that's another story.
Yeah, anyway. Even horror movies I like normally I'm a little bored. I'm like, okay, can we speed this up? Okay.
Find that with movies you do like sometimes when you're watching them. On rewatches, you love them all the way through, but sometimes with the first time around, you're wondering when it's getting to the end. I've had that happen, yeah.
Or, okay, I know, yeah, you're going to have okay, this is going to lead to that, and that's going to lead to that. Okay, can we just get to the point where John Wick kicks the guy in the head? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And then shoots him, and then shoots the guy on the other side of the room, and then shoots the guy closest to him again in the head, and then just for, you know, be safe, shoots the guy once more.
That was all of John Wick 3.
Yeah.
There was no buildup. The buildup was part 2. The 3 is just, if you've seen 3 yet, I don't know. Okay.
So many weird things happen in the movie, and I can't tell. Is this just a pastiche of everything that the director, Panos Cosmatos, thought was cool? Or, you know, is this its own kind of story? And maybe if we enjoy ourselves this much, if we get that engrossed in it, it probably doesn't matter. Though if people are trying to learn writing lessons from this, like, I'm kind of scared leaving it there. But
I mean, if you were to read the summary, I'm like, you got to be kidding me, right? It's like, isn't that like creative writing 101? Don't do the revenge story, or don't. It's like the easiest motivation or something.
Well,
sometimes.
Sure.
Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it depends on how it's done.
Well, you know, we definitely have a hero's journey. So, yeah, there's a turn. Mandy is no more. And Nicolas Cage was left for, I don't think he was left for dead.
No.
And I think it was one of those deliberate shows of power. Like, we don't even have to kill you. That's how unimportant you are. We're just going to leave.
We have broken you. Your mind is now shattered. Okay. I remember watching the scene when she's burning. At first, I think they're hanging her in front of him. And then, no, she's still alive and kicking. She's kicking as she's being set on fire.
Yeah.
And it's horrible. And then the one guy says, he makes that comment about, what is it? Like, the darker the horror, the brighter she burns, or something like that. You want to murder that man right then and there, you know?
And the movie, kind of the way it sets up, you know, the inciting incident, we have, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes of Red reacting. And what happens is, like, his hands and arms are so bloody that he's able to slip through the wires they've tied him with. And he's in shock. We know that Red is a lumberjack, and he's alive. And the main reason he wanted to live is now gone. So those of us familiar with revenge stories, it's like, okay, here we go. And instead of rushing to the, let's say, James Cameron arming oneself scene, you know, it's like, okay, the armor and then the gun and then the ammunition and the, let's get excited about the killing that's going to take place because this person is a badass, right? We kind of watch Red deal with his shock, and then eventually he starts drinking, which helps him get out of his shock to where he can actually get his voice back. And then we watch him break down for longer than we would normally watch someone break down in a normal movie, which is why, and that scene I think is so great, and it's kind of a redemption for the B scene in The Wicker Man.
When he has the howl, when he's yeah. wearing that tiger shirt, right? And yep. he's in his underwear and he sits and he just starts screaming, and we're understanding, you know, this is like a, it almost feels like a delayed reaction. Like it's just,
yeah.
Like he comes in and sees the Cheddar Goblin commercial and just says Cheddar Goblin and doesn't know what to say after that.
Yeah, it seems like the content of what's on TV is sometimes mocking the characters in the actual movie. Which is the only sense we got, right? That there might be some humor in this.
Yeah. Although there's humor in this movie. I mean, Even the scene where Mandy is going to be, when she starts laughing at Jeremiah Sands, that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because I realize that at least this character, is something horrible is going to happen to her, but at least she's going out with some dignity. Because basically he wasn't able to get anything over on her. She basically humiliated him in front of his cult and just starts laughing at his song and just, you know, and I don't know. I that's why I feel that even though she is a victim, she's, in a way, there's at least a dignity in how she goes out. I don't know if that's what you got from that or not.
But. Yeah. You know, if she didn't, right, she probably just would have been kidnapped.
Yeah.
And it would have been a different story. But yeah, no, she goes down that road of conflict and yeah, it's bad. And actually upsetting. And I feel like, you know, there are some horror movies when they get into this territory where they want you to feel dirty.
Yeah.
You know, like there's kind of a purient thing happening where maybe we're supposed to identify with the horrible people doing the killing. And, you know, like I didn't feel that.
Well, I am going to say another thing interesting. When she's on fire, she's covered. We don't actually see. She's in a bag, so we don't actually see her skin frying off or melting off. Do you understand?
I think but it's not a close-up. It's not, like, you can see something.
I mean, they made a point about George Romero. I heard a point about George Romero in Dawn of the Dead, how if it's a character you care about in the movie and they die, the death happens off-screen. Like one of the guys in the beginning, he's so horrified by the zombies, one of the SWAT guys, he puts a gun to his head, but you don't see his head getting shot off, even though he could have shown that because this isn't a bad person. Whereas the bad people, you get to see them die in these horrible ways in Dawn of the Dead. Whereas he cuts away from the characters we care about.
Yeah.
That makes any sense, yeah. So I don't know, I kind of got that from this, at least with Mandy. At least we're not seeing... I mean, it's horrible what's happening to her, but at least we're not seeing the gratuitous stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Well, there's a little bit, at least after, right? I mean, he tries to recover the body, and it's like, okay,
yeah, that's true.
It's like these ashes are not stable enough to actually bury.
He's not going to be able to even bury her head. Yeah, it kind of disintegrates on him. I remember that. Yeah, yeah. By then, the cult's left, though, so at least they're not able to jeer at that. But yeah, it's. And I think the ashes are still hot when he touches them, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he makes a visit to his friend.
The actor's name, I had it up a minute ago. He's been in a lot of Schwarzenegger movies. He was in Commando. He was in Predator.
So Bill Duke is the name of the actor.
Bill Duke,
and
yes,
the actor's name is Carruthers.
The character's name, yes. Carruthers in this, yes.
So, like, an older black man living in a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it turns out, like, yeah, he's even more remote than Red and Mandy were. And it turns out he was holding onto a crossbow for Mandy, which is the first hint we get very directly that Red might know his way around weapons. And I think the movie can't make up its mind whether or not Red is a ninja or just a dude.
I don't know. They allude a bit to his past. He must know his way around a weapon, because isn't that some kind of crossbow?
Oh, yeah, it's a crossbow. And then Carruthers, for some reason, like, made these, like, armor-piercing arrows or some crap.
Yeah, I don't know. And the name of it, by the way, is called the Reaper. So I was wondering, too, when Mandy mentioned the Reaper, if she's talking about this weapon that Red had, and that she knows Red's going to come out with the weapon and kill these people. I don't know.
Probably. Now, yeah.
Okay.
So I didn't watch this with captions. I'm starting to think maybe I should have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so trippy that sometimes it's kind of hard to see exactly.
You're not going
to
get everything the first times.
Yeah.
And then he asks, do you want more weapons? Do you want some more or something? Because he has like a full arsenal in there.
Well, he goes, well, if you're hunting, and then you're probably going to need these. And he pulls out the special arrows, and Red's like, yep.
Oh, that's right.
And then Carruthers actually gives Red the exposition, like, okay, you know, he basically sets up who these people are. And, it's where we find out about the bikers. So it was the perfect place to give us some exposition.
Yeah.
And like a 4-minute scene. And that sets up the rest of the movie when, you know, he's going on this revenge quest. And I can't say this enough, between the cinematography and the lighting and some of the special effects, like the starry sky at night out in the woods, I get the feeling like that was enhanced. That's not just sticking a camera there and going, oh, look, it's really bright and clear. I you know, it looks like a cheesy science fiction painting.
I wonder, we only get stuff like that. Do we only get stuff like that at night, in scenes done at night in this movie?
I think so.
Because I'm trying to think back, when Carruthers, you don't get anything like that. That's the first time in the movie he actually talked to anybody too about what happened. And it's almost like this is, it's not really, I don't think it's really surreal at all.
No. Well, this is like a couple hours after it happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from this point, after whenever Nicolas Cage falls asleep or becomes unconscious, it switches to these really trippy animated sequences with Mandy in the woods, taking care of animals and stuff like that.
And I was wondering, are those based on her paintings that she was doing? I'm not sure what she exactly, I don't know. Because I know he was commenting on her paintings earlier on, and I was wondering if this is...
Well, they're portraying her as this kind of spiritual entity, you know, kind of the Earth Mother, and whether or not this is something really happening, or whether this is just Nicolas Cage's traumatic imagination.
Like if she's calling to him from the beyond, or if this is just his messed up head that we're seeing this stuff in. Yeah,
and
I don't know.
For the rest of the movie, I think that's an open question. Like, we don't get the answer to that.
I know that she was reading some sword and sorcery novel. I think it had a wizard pulling a jewel out. And I think she does that in one of the animated scenes later in the movie. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm reading too much into things.
But I wasn't lying when I said that it looks like a movie Kubrick might have directed. You know, it has so many beautiful sequences and doesn't stop it from being visceral and horrible. Now, when the Black Skulls were summoned, right, the sort of lieutenant of this cult hands the main one a mason jar filled with this horrible liquid that has the LSD in it. And the guy, he's wearing one of those GIMP masks, and he just
and like
gulps
spikes
it all
over his body and just
he gulps it all down, and it's like all over his, like, it's not an ideal way to get the substance into your body. But also, if ever you see this, don't put this in your body. But what's great is, you know, as Nicolas Cage starts killing his way up the food chain, he actually finds a mason jar filled with a substance, and he puts a little on the tip of his finger and puts it onto his tongue, and he has a freak out beyond, like, it's just instant nightmare LSD freak out.
Oh, yeah, his, like, face melts off.
And it's like, that's what one drop did, and this guy drank the whole thing.
Now, there are three of them, right? Three of the...
The bikers, yeah.
The bikers. I was trying to figure out how he kills each of them, because I know... Oh, no, wait, there were three, because there was one... There was the one he knocked down the pit inside the house, but then I think he comes back, right?
No, I think it was a second biker in the house as well.
Okay, yeah, okay. I don't know. I was losing track. You mentioned food chain. I find odd, because aren't the bikers the worst part of the food chain? Like, when you're done with them, isn't the Children of the New Dawn like Easy Street compared to these? That Maybe. Was my impression, but I don't know, because I'm watching these. The one guy is, he has a mountain of cocaine on a coffee table while he's watching a porno, and he's snorting like
a lot,
like a lot of it.
Like Tony Montoya, yeah.
It's like the scene, yeah, like the end scene in Scarface. I'm like, I don't know.
I was messing around online trying to find a script so I could just try and double check some of the language, and one of the scripts I saw, it was terrible, and I think it was like a fourth draft. So,
okay.
But like Red is narrating to himself, "Oh, cocaine, great, give me some cocaine," and you're like, "What?"
Maybe that was just for Nick Cage's benefit to know what was going on.
He doesn't have to narrate it. Like, well, just, well, and some of Jeremiah's speechifying was just not good either. So a lot of interesting things happened between whatever draft I saw and, you know, what the final version was. Because the writing seldom hurts the movie in what the final version is. And it just seemed like, yeah, I remember like these actors, a lot of them seem like they're straight out of a 70s, show or something like that. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because Red mentions chips at the beginning of the movie. So I don't know if that's what you're thinking of, like the Jeremiah Sands actor might've been on a show like Chips or something like that, you know?
Could be. Yeah. So I think in terms of brutality, yeah, nothing beats the Black Skulls. But also the Black Skulls don't have humanity.
Right.
Like as a conflict, it'd be like, okay, I have to fight a bear now.
That's what it feels like. Yeah. He's chained up. He starts off chained up. Then he comes out, and then he slits the throat of the one snorting the cocaine, and the blood spills all over his face. Was that visceral enough for you?
Yeah, and then then he has this bloody face for the rest of the movie, like war paint. And he takes practical steps to kind of, you know, armor himself.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look cool, which is one of the great things about the movie is, like, it's practical. James Cameron would not have made it look like that. Like, it was...
No.
In a Cameron movie, it would have looked cool, and instead, it's like, all right, you kind of look like a deranged crossing guard, but... good for you, I guess. And before he moves on to the Children of the New Dawn, he meets the chemist who I presume is the person who makes the LSD drink.
I'm assuming, yeah. That was an odd scene for me in this movie.
That's my favorite scene.
Okay, well, no, that's fine. I'm not saying it's a bad scene. I just, it that one confused me a bit. So there's a tiger in a cage, I think.
There's a tiger in a cage, and there's this, you know, it looks like this beautiful futuristic junkyard.
Yeah.
Like they're, like these giant light panels come up over this workspace, and it looks like, you know, there's machinery and there's a guy wearing coveralls, and it's this actor by the name of Richard Brake, who is famous for a few things. He played one of the three killers in Three from Hell. He was kind of the guest star, since, you know, Captain Spaulding really couldn't be one of the main villains in that. So he kind of pitched in, and he was also the heavy villain in Rob Zombie's 31. And he was the first zombie king on Game of Thrones. Two actors played that part, and Richard Brake was the first one.
Oh, so it wasn't just CGI. I'm messing with you.
Not just CGI, no.
Okay, yeah. I was very happy. I took a Game of Thrones quiz as to which villain are you on Game of Thrones. and I got the Night King, and I was very happy. If I'm going to be a villain on that show, that's the one I want to be.
Maybe one of the less rapey ones. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Just pure evil. No thought process.
Yeah. Like, evil, not a lot of malice, just evil. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, and I think the reason why it's such a strange moment is, yeah, Nicolas Cage, like, he's got this bloody face. He's wearing some armor. He's got these weapons. And then there's this dude hanging out. And Richard Brake's face is so ugly, it's beautiful. Right? I mean, it's just, he looks like a villain. And he could play a dumb, horrible villain, or he could play a really ingenious villain. And here, it's like he's not even playing a villain. It's like he's beyond good and evil. And
yeah,
he's
almost like a neutral. That's the impression I got. Maybe that, like, this is kind of outside of all this, you know? But maybe.
And he's the second helper on this quest. You know, the first one being, you know, Carruthers in the trailer, and then, all right, three murders later, and we kind of expect he's just going to keep killing and killing and killing. And, you know, we sense there's got to be some connection between Red and who had the t-shirt of the tiger, and then here's an actual tiger in a cage. And also, the chemist, his speech is strange, and there are times when it makes very clear sense, and he's appalled at what, you know, the Black Skulls and the Children of the New Dawn have done to him.
Mm-hmm.
It is like, I may make crazy LSD that's going to make people insane, but there's no cause for doing what they did to you. And then other things he says don't quite make sense. And then he lets the tiger out of the cage, at which point we expect, what, is Nick Cage going to have to kill the tiger that was in the cage? And it's like, nope, the tiger just leaves. And you're like, and the chemist tells Red where to find the Children of the New Dawn. And that's that. And so you didn't really expect, okay, here's a new exposition scene.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to say about that scene, except for the fact that that very same year, Nick Cage starred in another movie where he plays a hunter, and some criminal aboard a ship lets loose one of the dangerous animals from the cage. I had the name of it up a minute ago, but it was... That strikes me as a regular Nick Cage movie as opposed to the one we're watching here. In fact, what was the name of it called? It was called Primal. Yeah, I'll read you. You want me to read you the Amazon?
Sure.
A hunter, Nicolas Cage, must fight for his life on a ship when his deadly animals, including a rare white jaguar, are set loose by a dangerous criminal out to kill everyone on board.
Huh.
I should do that one for the blog. That sounds like... Anyway, okay, like, that's neither here nor there.
That you one sounds pretty good.
The conversation. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. Oh, man. Nick Cage. But no, I just get the feeling that it's there so we can find out where the Brotherhood of the New Dawn is. That's what I'm figuring. That's all I got out of the scene, but you got... like, I probably need to watch it again, okay?
Well, but, you know, one of the things it does is it recalibrates our sense of the revenge mission, because right. The bad version of this movie is, I'm just going to walk up to every person who ever wronged me, and I'm just going to chop their head off, and I'm just going to kill and kill and kill until I'm done. It's like, here's a scene where there's no killing. There's no transaction involving killing that needs to happen here. I get the sense he may have released the tiger. The chemist would not have been surprised if Nicolas Cage killed him. Like, why should you trust the chemist?
I think he said something too about the tiger was a judge of character. Like, the tiger would start snarling or something if you were no good. That's what I know you're not going to do, because the tiger would be acting up if you were. I think he said something to that effect. Okay. And when he lets the tiger out, the tiger just walks past Nick Cage, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It was a weird scene. You have that 80s synth playing, and then he just turns off the stereo and it stops playing. Did you notice that?
Yeah, yeah.
The part of the soundtrack, which and I it just was
makes
funny.
Us wonder, like, what the hell is actually happening in the reality of this movie? How much of this is in Nick Cage's head? And is he still tripping? But
he snorted some cocaine and took a droplet of whatever was in that jar.
And
plus, he's probably going out of his mind a little bit too. So.
There's that. Yeah, and considering the trauma he's experienced, like, wouldn't be surprised if he's not thinking right anyway.
Yes, exactly.
And so he ends up, you know, I think we've had spoilers aplenty in our discussion, but it's this thing where, you know, he does keep killing, and it's almost set up like a video game in that it's not like everybody's hanging out in one place and he just has to try and fight them all at the same time. Instead, it's kind of like he never has to face more than two people at once, and there are some surprises in there that I would like to preserve for anyone who hasn't seen Mandy yet, who's going to go and check it out.
Yeah.
I will say that the movie does manage to be visionary as he keeps going, you know, from kind of station to station trying to enact his revenge, so that the movie looks improbably beautiful as he's traveling.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. There is, you can have beauty in horror. If that makes any sense.
I think normally there isn't, but this movie.
Well, not in the aforementioned movies, the visceral movies that you mentioned, the 80s. In fact, you'll notice as the 80s peel on, they start putting more and more supernatural stuff in the movies because they, I think even they were getting tired of it. Like if you look at like Nightmare on Elm Street, I mean, you know, you have the kid being the wizard, you know, in the one dream, or you know, you have anyway. I'm rambling.
I believe you're referring to the Dream Warriors, Jeffrey.
The Dream Warriors, yes.
Can't believe I remember that. I saw that in the theater.
You saw that? How was the crowd's reaction to that? I'm curious. Do you remember anything out of your
head? Well, for the most part, it felt kind of cathartic. It felt more cathartic than shark jumping. When, you know, when it comes to having nightmares, like one of the things that a psychologist might tell you is when you're having a dream, partly you know you're having a dream. So if you're being chased by something horrible, you can turn around and confront it. And so like that was the major premise of that movie is instead of just being the terrified victim running away, like you could turn to face your, you know, the monster, and you could also, because this is a dream, give yourself superpowers.
Yeah.
Which worked out with various results.
But at least they tried.
Yeah.
At least they went out swinging, even if they did die, right? Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I loved. Another 80s movie, which was a follow-up to a 70s movie, was Phantasm 2. And I don't know if you've ever seen any of the Phantasm movies.
I think I've seen them all, but okay. I don't have much recollection.
What's interesting about Phantasm 2 is it takes place many years later, and the people, you know, the boy's now grown up. He's a young man now, and he goes with the ice cream guy, you know, from the first movie. And what I thought was interesting, though, in my opinion, it kind of introduced the quest to the horror movie, because instead of them running away from the tall man, they're running toward him to try and kill him, even though they know they probably won't succeed, but they have to try, you know? And I thought that was interesting. So there is something to say about running toward the evil rather than being defensive and running away from
it. As like the least worst plan.
Exactly. So I do find that interesting. But were you overall satisfied with the ending of Mandy? We won't say what it is, but were you satisfied with it?
Well, you know, one of the ways I described it was it's a tone poem.
Okay.
Like as a classic story, I'm not sure how I feel. But because of the way that the movie feels so indeterminate in terms of what reality is, and it holds together enough so that it's not simple randomness throughout the entire thing. Like, I think this is probably the most interesting way to film a revenge story if you have to do one more.
Right.
So
like if Michael Winner had directed this, the guy that Death Wish 2, you wouldn't have the same feeling on the movie, probably.
No, and I feel a lot of curiosity about Panos Cosmatos. I know that he's got one other movie.
Yeah, it was made 8 years prior. I actually want to watch it now. Beyond the Black Rainbow, I think it's called. Yeah,
Beyond the Black Rainbow. Got to check that out, because I would like to know how in control he is of, you know, his storytelling. Because nothing in this movie is that original, but in the way that it was presented, it felt very fresh and vital and companionable in a way. And this is a better love story than most love stories. So I think
that's true.
You know,
this is a love story.
A powerful love story. So, I mean, this bears out one of the main things I try and teach, you know, as a creative writing teacher, which is, You owe your audience a good story. You don't necessarily owe your audience an original story. You don't have to reinvent everything, but you have to make every moment count. And if you could do that, you know, you've done enough.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, my summary makes the movie sound kind of terrible. And that's not the way it feels.
It's the style over the substance. That's what you like. To put it simply, maybe not. You're wincing, aren't you?
Well,
that or the
if we say it's style over substance, like, no, because I feel
that's what the Neon Demon was.
It's like, okay.
No, you're right, because there is substance here, because like I said, the love story, we do care about all the characters here. Yeah, so no.
Like, the movie's goofy. There's no avoiding that. You know, like, I'm not sure how great I feel about trying to generalize, like, okay, everyone, right, make movies like Mandy. Cosmatos, how many movies like this could you make?
I don't know.
But I do think it says a lot about committing yourself to your aesthetic and finding ways to make it new.
Yeah.
How about you, Jeff?
How about me what?
Well, you're the one who recommended this movie.
Oh.
Out of all the movies that we are trying to put in this list, like, this was your top one.
This is probably in my top 10 movies of 2018. I do think what this movie is, I think this is the saving of Nicolas Cage. Because Nicolas Cage had been on a crash course before this. Though I do, like you said, I do appreciate the Ghost Rider movies. But I, just in general, I'd watch bad Nick Cage movie. Did I watch one with him in... I think I watched one with him in Medieval Times with Ron Perlman, and he was hunting witches. Does that sound familiar?
A little.
I think I saw a movie with that. I don't know. And
that's not even going to be The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
He wasn't The Sorcerer's Apprentice. He was in that. He was in Disney movies.
Yeah.
He was in National Treasure 1 and 2, which I used to refer to as the Dollar Bill movies. But no, why do I like Mandy? Here's what I like about Mandy. I love the main character, Mandy, because like I say, typically in one of these movies, I feel, you know, something terrible is going to happen to Mandy and I'm dreading it. And when she goes, "You wrote that," and starts laughing at Jeremiah Sands, I'm laughing with her. I'm saying, you know what? At least you're going on your feet. Okay. You're standing tall going out instead of, you know, on your knees, so to speak. It was kind of going for that 80s style that I know Stranger Things is, you know, the whole synth wave music, but it didn't feel tired in this movie, if that makes any sense. But it also doesn't feel like a movie that could have been made in the 80s. But what do you think? Could you have seen this being made in the 80s, even though I do think it's influenced by the 80s?
I doubt that this movie could have been made in the 80s and be as smart as it was.
Right.
And I don't know where the smartness came from. Like, it could have been the last draft of the last screenplay. It could have been the actors just winging it after, you know, like, okay, let's make sure we hit the story beats, but let's improve some of the dialogue here. I don't know. You know, I think of Cannibal Holocaust, which, you know, was absolutely frightening and kind of gave you this sense of horror at, you know, being in the woods.
That's the documentary style film.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never seen that.
It's really grotesque.
I've heard it is. I've seen other cannibal movies. I did review Jess Franco. I reviewed Jess Franco's cannibal movie. I think it was just called The Cannibals. And I'm sure you read that blog that I posted. That movie was so bad that even he disavows it.
Well, Cannibal Holocaust is one of those few movies where it's like, we're going to shock you. And it's like, ho-hum, whatever. And it's like, oh my God. Oh God. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't watch this. And it had a reputation for a while as, you know, the documentary style footage looks so real that the legend had it that people actually died in the making of it. But, you know, it's just so grotesque. But the way it used music and the way it had these different layers, like, it was kind of like the frame for the movie was really smart. And then the characterizations were so horrible that it made me ashamed to be a human being.
So you felt dirty after watching it?
Oh, yeah. No, something's wrong if you don't feel dirty after watching Cannibal Holocaust. And here, I just feel like there is a sense that there is such a thing as beauty in the cosmos and beauty in human beings, and that these horrible things can do great harm to that, but they can't eradicate that, especially if we fight for the things that we care about. So I just don't think any movie from the 80s would have curated all these different things and put it together in quite this way. So while this does feel like a pastiche of like so many other things, and you can kind of sense that, you know, and yeah, there's a guy in a leather outfit who is snorting cocaine and watching porn by himself, and you're like, okay, this guy's not the coolest rock star.
Have you ever been in a house like that?
I have. No. None of my friends can afford cocaine, Jeffrey.
Okay. I was in a weird house with some pit bulls, but that might be a story for another time. But yeah, I don't, you have to understand, with me this past decade, I'm just trying to look for movies that stand out, and oftentimes they don't, but this one just stood out for me. And I think I argued for once Nick Cage is not annoying me in this movie. I'm actually appreciating what he's doing here.
Yeah, I always want him to do well, and he breaks my heart.
That's the thing. We always want him to do well because we like him as an actor, but he's in bad films. Like I said, I did see Face Off 3 times. In the theater. That was when they were courting John Woo to direct all these Hollywood movies. I remember that time.
Well,
period.
I think one of the reasons why maybe we like this movie also is that our heroes are older. So many horror movies, right? I mean, the main audience is normally, what, teenage boys?
Oh, yes.
I think that demographic has enlarged, you know, in recent times as, you know, nerd culture is spreading. But when you see a movie that just seems like you've seen this story so many times before, and it's like, okay, but here's the latest batch with new teen actors. And it's like, well,
you're right.
I'm not sure how much more callow youth I can watch just suffer when the actors seem bored, and I don't know, like It Follows, right? Like, I remember the word on that is, oh my God, like there's never been a movie like this before, and it's so great. And the movie ended before I got to the point where I cared.
Yeah, that was another one of the quote unquote art house movies I was trying to think of. That was another one, the art house horror movies. It's when I was a kid, I didn't necessarily want to see younger people on the screen. I mean, when I was watching the Star Trek movies, I know you're not a fan, but like the crew of the Enterprise were middle aged at that point in those movies. You know, I mean, I'm seeing older characters in movies all the time. And a lot of horror movies that would come out, especially recently, they'd have young actors in them. They were always well-to-do, too, the characters in these movies, which always drove me crazy, because at least have them working at a McDonald's part-time or something, you know. I will say a horror movie that came out recently that did have younger people in it, I believe was called Don't Breathe. That was interesting. I don't know if you'd like that one or not. That might be a good one for next year.
Yeah.
And I think what I liked about those kids is that they kind of came from a poorer background. Okay. So maybe that made me identify with them better. Cause at least maybe if you have less money when you're a kid, you seem more worldly. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's not so much the age, but the character seems more worldly. If you get what I'm saying. And usually that is an older actor.
Yeah.
Cause you know, Nick Cage has been through stuff before this movie starts. I mean, Red's been through stuff. I keep wanting to call him Nick Cage because that's all I see on this. But no, he's been through stuff. Remember when he's on the copter and the guy hands him a beer after a hard day's work, and he's like, no.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's alluding to him having a drinking problem or a substance abuse problem. He just refuses that beer. You know, he seems on edge until he runs into Mandy. So I'm wondering if maybe she did something for him in his life, like he was like I don't know if it's like the Clint Eastwood character in Unforgiven, how he was a bad man, but then he got married and I guess his wife changed him, or the woman he fell in love with changed him and he had kids and made him less severe.
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm reaching problems.
I've had to stop drinking, not because I couldn't stop, but because elevated liver functions for other reasons. And it's like, you can't take
right
liver medication and then drink on top of it.
Right, right.
And my doctor said, you know, after a couple of years, it's like, well, you could cheat like once a month. But if you're never drinking, then it's like the hangover just introduces itself pretty early in the evening. It's like, oh, okay, oh. No, there's no. So it's like, it's just easier not to drink. Yeah. And if I'm working too hard, there's nothing to look forward to. Like, I'm going to bust my ass. And at the end of the day, I'm going to have a cold drink. And then my spine is going to relax. And I'm going to feel cool. And yeah, I will feel like the world is an okay place. And if you can't drink, what are you going to look forward to? And for Red, he looks forward to spending time with Mandy. And because they're such quiet people, it's not, you know, simply, oh, let's jump into bed or hop up and down or like, no, it's this very quiet, gentle relationship that they have that we get to watch over time.
Yeah. Of course, we do get to catch a scene of where they met each other at the end, if that's spoiling things. But, you know, they meet each other. Is that at a bar or a party?
I don't know.
And they just look at each other. Okay, maybe it's not important at all. Okay.
But just slowing down and spending more time on characters, you know, it can take what is, and this may be shocking to people, you know, the revenge story. You know, in schlock, in B movies, in Z movies, right? There are just a whole lot of movies that are in this genre.
Kill Bill's a revenge story.
Kill Bill?
Yeah.
Django Unchained, also kind of in that category. I Spit on Your Grave is a classic.
That's a very visceral film.
Yeah, that's a hard one to watch.
It is. It's Joe Bob Briggs. That was when Joe Bob Briggs got into a lot of trouble for liking. People went after him over that. I remember that back when it came out.
Yeah.
Last House on the Left, that's a revenge film.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's kind of borrowing from all this stuff. There's a chainsaw in this movie too. You know, if he has a chainsaw at the beginning of the movie, you know it's coming back. That's a spoiling thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I still haven't seen Color Out of Space. I know that's the movie made after that, but I know that we have a planned commentary on that later in the month, right?
If you like it anywhere near as much as I did, yeah.
Okay.
So exceeded by expectations.
I know Lovecraft adaptations can be hit or miss sometimes.
Well, we can address that on a future episode.
Okay.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Jeff Schuster, who is the curator of Schlock, Alexander Pate, and Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart, The Diaries of a Salted Scribbler, and yes, The Curator of Schlock. If you enjoyed listening to this conversation, please do spread the word on social media. And if you've not yet done so, leave a review over on Apple Podcasts. All right, I think I'm going to go make myself a drink. Until next time, gang. Put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week, I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.